propaganda versus the truth. You're with Swedish-British journalist Pelle Nyroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show with me, Basil Valentine. Sitting in for Pelle today, Thursday the 16th of May 2024. And I hope it's not a disappointment to see my sunny face on this lovely early summer's day here in Europe. Early afternoon here, late morning in the United States, and just after midnight on Friday morning in Australia. As usual on the show, we've got a packed program of highly intelligent and informative guests with unique perspectives that you won't get on the lying corporate media. First of those is Goran Adamson, sociologist and professor. Goran is associate professor in sociology and senior lecturer in the Department of Sociology at Uppsala University in Sweden. His latest book, Masochistic Nationalism, Multicultural Self-Hatred, and the Infatuation with the Exotic, published a couple of years ago, identifies two forms of nationalism in contemporary society, both white supremacist and anti-white, and explores their similarities and differences. I must say, I am particularly looking forward to this fascinating exposition, and Goran will be with me in just a few minutes. Later in the first hour, Richard Poe will be joining me. Richard is a New York Times best-selling author and award-winning journalist. His best-known book is The Shadow Party, an expose of George Soros and his color revolutions, co-written with David Horowitz. Poe is currently presently writing The History of Globalism, and his work can be found at richardpoe.substack.com and richardpoe.com. His new book, How the British Invented Communism, will be published shortly, and I'll be fascinated to hear Richard's perspectives on events in Slovakia and Georgia, where there may be color revolutions underway as we speak. In the second hour, my first guest is Tammy Cuthbert Garcia. Tammy is a naturally inspired health practitioner, and she's fighting medical enslavement through community commerce. Tammy is also promoting her annual Naturally Inspired Health Summit, so I look forward to that. And finally, in the second hour, I'm delighted to say I'll be joined by Aaron Cariati, the Brownstone Institute counsellor. Aaron is a scholar at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and a former professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine, where he is a director of medical ethics. His book, The New Abnormal, The Rise of the Biomedical Security State, is particularly apt given the UK government are claiming that we're about to see a whole new wave of antibiotic-resistant microbes and infections heading our way. I can't help thinking that a lot of people whose immune systems have been compromised by various experimental injections over the last few years may be the ones most to suffer. But before that, Goran Adamson, so we're going to take a very short break, and then I'll be joined by Goran Adamson for a fascinating expose on the state of Europe, nationalism, internationalism, global, and what hope is there for the European culture we all know and love. We'll be right back after this very short break.
Keeping the commitment 24/7.
I come to you for facts. I really appreciate what you and your team do.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Pelle today, Thursday the 16th of May. I'm delighted to say that still on the line is Goran Adamson. Welcome back to the program, Goran.
Thank you so much, Basil.
Oh, that's better. We can hear you much more clearly now. And it's your words that matter, after all. Your tremendous intellect is what we want to get to know here on TNT. So, yes. Masochistic nationalism, the floor is yours. Please explain to our readers what you mean by that.
Right. You know, I can take it very quickly from the start. I was actually reading about nationalism. I was sitting on a cafe in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, and I was reading about nationalism, And then I thought, well, this is interesting because I knew people who were, you know, the multicultural entourage and their views about their nation and the way they criticized their own nation and so forth. And I thought it was a bit very stereotypical. And then I thought, well, hey, maybe I should Google something. And then I figured maybe I should just type negative nationalism, because I thought that could possibly capture a little bit the kind of multicultural idea that you're interested in your nation, but not to praise it, but to harass it and criticize it. So I simply Googled negative nationalism, and there it was. It just popped up an old essay dealing about these things with, you know, in a way that clearly I wouldn't be able to. And the guy who wrote this essay was called Notes on Nationalism, and the guy who wrote this essay was called George Orwell, which was quite interesting. And then he is writing exactly about these things. He's writing about people who are very interested in their own culture, their own identity, their own politics, their own background, their own history, and so forth. But not in order to praise it, like an old stuffy, you know, jingoist or nationalist, but in order to harass it and in order to compare it and always to try to find reasons to compare it, not favorably to other nations like a nationalist, but unfavorably to other nations. For instance, they can speak about Swedish folk music. They can speak about, you know, they can speak about Hungarian traditions or whatever. And they do it, and then they laugh, and then they say, it's ridiculous. And then they praise other customs, faraway customs, customs overseas, as you so nicely put it in English. So that was the start of the whole idea and what turned out to be my book. But maybe I'm talking too much. Maybe you have some smart question here. I should bring you in.
No, on the contrary, we want to hear you talk, Goran. I know what you mean about that. It's a sort of grass is greener thing, really. People feel that other countries do things better, and our intellectuals are often embarrassed by their own folk culture as being, somewhat trite or lowbrow or something. I'm currently in France, and I'm always enormously impressed by the overall standard of living here. The French demand high standards from their railways, from their food producers, and in Britain we seem to be willing to accept much lower standards. Having said that, I'm not one to denigrate Britain, whether I'm there or I'm overseas. What I'm concerned about with the rise of globalism is that national differences will be erased and we're all going to end up living in a single multicultural soup. No real distinction from one country to the other. And people may think that this is alarmist, but I think indigenous cultures in Europe are worth preserving, and they are in danger of disappearing under a tidal wave of Hollywood-esque monoculture. Go on.
Yeah, that's right. True, Basil. I think we seem to be on the same track here. But you know, these are one of the underlying, actually, your point you address, suggest one of the underlying themes in my book. And so, my book is called Masochistic Nationalism: Multicultural Self-Hatred and the Infatuation with the Exotic. And so, the title tells a lot about what the book is about, namely that while we do not accept some kind of, you know, the indigenous culture of Sweden, we are very happy to accept and praise the indigenous culture of, you know, Yemen or Iraq or Hanoi or, you know, Vietnam or Thailand and so forth. And that I think that doesn't really make sense. If you are in favor of preserving cultures in general, you cannot say that Western cultures are not worth preserving, but non-Western cultures are worth preserving. I mean, you can say it, but you are not consistent if you go on like that. And let me just say also that if you talk about, you can test these multiculturalists or these people I refer to as the masochistic nationalists, self-hating nationalists. You can tickle them under their feet, so to speak, and you can, or test them. You can say that, okay, suppose I go to Portugal. Do you think I'd like to meet
like Swedes. Do you think I want to go to Portugal to eat Swedish food? And every single multiculturalist, every single nice, sweet, you know, tidy little leftist, they would say, of course not. And then I say, well, hang on a second. Well, then if people go to Britain or to Ireland or to Sweden, do you think Portuguese people want to come here to eat Portuguese food? I guess not. I mean, if so, they wouldn't travel, would they? But if you raise these issues to these people, these left wingers, they simply have no answer. I mean, the only answer, if they are consistent, the only answer they could possibly come up with is to say that, well, I think Western cultures suck, but I think Eastern cultures are lovely. Indian culture or whatever, or, you know, Jordan or whatever, anything overseas, anything culturally obsolete and very different. That is, they can say that because then it actually makes sense. All of these contradictions are piling up.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, I think there's a degree of virtue signaling when it comes to,
of course,
Western liberals and intellectuals praising non-European cultures. I think there's a degree of fashion and ego about it. Look, I identify with this exotic culture and I exalt it. And that reflects well on me. That's part of my self-image, like the clothes that I wear and all the rest of it. And so people seek to sort of use different cultures almost like ornaments or bangles to wear about them. But another key point, I think, is the quality of culture. Now we're going to get into a very tricky area, Goran, and unfortunately we've only got a few minutes left, but I feel constrained to touch upon this. And, you know, are we allowed to say in the West that the music of Bach, Beethoven, Wagner, and Mozart, Puccini is superior to other cultures' music because it is more sophisticated, it has greater depth, it shows more intellectuality, and it is more moving to the human soul? Or, you know, the danger is that is going to be verboten even as an idea before long.
Yes, you know, that's a tough one, and I could start talking about the weather here in Berlin instead to avoid what you just said. But, yes, you can say that. And as a matter of fact, right here in Berlin, there was a scene at Alexanderplatz. I saw this woman, maybe she was in her 60s, and she had these very loose clothes, and she looked like a nice, sweet left-winger. She was dancing slowly and looking, you know, had this in-love face. She was dancing slowly to the rhythms of there was an African guy. He was banging the drums, and he was good. He was good in what he was doing, but she was dancing slowly to the rhythms of his drums. And then I simply thought, well, you wouldn't listen to Mozart, would you? And then I had this heretic thought. I simply thought, well, that banging of those drums, it's nice, but after a few minutes, you get a little bit tired of it, you know. It cannot go on for 20 minutes or an hour. And another thing, if you bang on these drums, there's no start and there's no end to it. Whereas if you listen to a symphony by Beethoven, it has its own form, you know, the start of it, continuation and climax and at the end. And so we could talk about these things at great length. And yes, I think, it's a good example of also kind of self-abasing left-wing intellectuals who are not at all interested in classical music, you know, which I think is the apex of music in the world anywhere, Mozart or Beethoven or Shostakovich or whatever. But at the same time, they are completely in love with what you might actually say is more primitive types of music. And as I say this, I know that people will like kill me, but feel free. I will, and I think we would agree on that. I also think it is actually a kind of the racism of low expectations to say that to say that that banging, playing the drums, which is a great thing in itself, but that necessarily is as sophisticated as playing the violin or a piano, which I think it is not. It is simply not as sophisticated. And if you deny that, you know nothing about music, right? So.
I'm inclined to agree with you wholeheartedly, Goran. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I'm very keen to get you back as a guest, either here on the Paddy Neroth Taylor Show or elsewhere on TNT in the very near future, because I'm personally very keen to explore these very important themes in more detail. Yeah. Goran, thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Basil. Thanks for talking, and have a nice day. Thanks a lot.
You too, Gordon, and we'll speak to you again soon. We're going to take a short break now on TNT, and when we come back, I'll be joined by Richard Poe, the New York Times best-selling author and award-winning journalist, and his new book, The Shadow Party. We'll be right back after this short break.
Military families often sacrifice precious time away from loved ones while serving our country. And for those with children, the separation can be especially difficult.
We were worried that with him leaving, that she would lose those connections with her dad.
Some of life's best moments happen between parents, children, and the pages of a good book. United Through Reading provides that connection.
You can watch your mom or dad read a book to you, and it almost feels like they're really there.
We ensure they remain a consistent, meaningful part of their children's lives, no matter the distance.
Just seeing Jacob recognize Daddy again after a long time just melted my heart.
And now, as we're facing greater isolation from our loved ones, United Through Reading is also available to veterans. Learn more about United Through Reading and download our free secure app at unitedthroughreading.org.
I'm Sandra, this is Jorge, and we were adopted in 2019. I remember when they first came to us, Michael was already a teenager. The whole cliche of, they're so lucky to have you guys, and it's the other way around. They have changed our family for the better. They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
Exposing the deep state and government overreach. You're with Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Pella today, Thursday the 16th of May. Richard Poe is a New York Times best-selling author and award-winning journalist. His best-known book is The Shadow Party, an expose of George Soros and his color revolutions, co-written with David Horowitz. Richard is currently writing a history of globalism. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you, Basil. Great to be here.
George Soros, not my favorite person, getting on in years now. Have we seen the last of his attempts to undermine Western democracy with his assorted NGOs, bribing of politicians and insertion of appalling attorney generals across the United States? I believe he seems to be passing on the torch to his son, and the horror show that he has set in motion is going to continue.
Yes, there is a lot of attention on his son now, who is we're obviously supposed to believe is going to take over the operation. I don't think he's had that much experience in this area. He's mostly been known in the past, I'm talking about Alex Soros, for hobnobbing in Hollywood and the Hamptons with celebrities and that sort of thing. It is my opinion that the real power at the Open Society Foundations is its president, who is Lord Mark Malik Brown. And Brown is a long-standing friend and colleague and associate of Mr. George Soros, going back to, I think, 1986 was when they met. And the way they met is that Brown, by his own admission, the way he tells the story, he approached Mr. Soros for help in manipulating an election, I believe, in the Philippines. And so Brown has been a very high-level British statesman, a diplomat, and very involved with the UN and other areas of foreign affairs. But he seems to have specialized very much in what I would call regime change operations, color revolutions, and that sort of thing. And he's worked very closely with Mr. Soros through the years on all these things. So it looks to me as if Mr. Soros appointed Malik Brown. I've been calling him Brown. I guess he's Malik Brown. He appointed him just after the U.S. election back in 2020. And I think he put him in place there so he could actually run things. So when his son came in, Alex could more or less act as a figurehead while Lord Malik Brown was actually running things. That's the way I see it. Others may see it differently.
And the Shadow Party, the title of your book, what is their end game? What are they hoping to achieve with these current revolutions, with their undermining of Western democracy? What kind of society do they want to impose on us, Richard?
Well, I think if we look at the World Economic Forum and the types of things that Klaus Schwab is talking about, I think this is evidently the kind of society they want for us. What's interesting is that Soros, of course, has always been very close to the WEF, the World Economic Forum. He's completely shared its views, as far as I can tell, right down the line. And none of this is really surprising when you get beneath the propaganda about Western democracy and what it's supposed to be and what we've all supposedly been engaged in since the end of World War II, trying to make the world safe for democracy and so forth. When you get behind that propagandistic facade, I think the actual goal of our ruling classes, let's say, is perhaps much more sinister. And it is my belief, which I have I've talked about with your colleague Pelly a bit, and which I've written about in my most recent book, which just came out yesterday, actually. It's called How the British Invented Communism and Blamed It on the Jews. Basically, what I talk about in that book is the very answer to your question. Soros and these color revolutions are part of a system of global manipulation and global power seeking, in which the British Empire in particular has excelled for at least the last 200 years or more. What I argue in my new book is that the age of revolution, which of course began in the late 18th century, and let's say it continued through the Russian Revolution of 1917, but I argue that it's no coincidence that this age of revolution coincided with the rise of the British Empire and the rise of Great Britain as the global hegemon, because I believe that color revolution, which is to say the staging of fake revolutions or the covert overthrowing of governments and staging coups and replacing governments, but under the guise of a people's uprising. So that what you actually have is a foreign intelligence service staging a coup, but it's made to look like a people's revolution, like an uprising of the people. I believe that the British did this in France in 1789, overthrowing King Louis XVI, and I believe they did it in Russia because they had their own reasons for overthrowing Tsar Nicholas II. And so this thing that we now call color revolutions, it's a kind of trendy term that we all started using after the breakup of the USSR. But my research shows that this has been going on for a very long time. And I have identified the British Empire as being the primary beneficiary and the primary perpetrator of this sort of coup. And it does appear to me that the removal of France as a formidable rival to Great Britain through a color revolution, the French Revolution, and the removal of Russia as a major threat in 1917. And the British establishment did perceive Russia as a very great threat. These two regime change operations were extremely necessary for British foreign policy reasons, for the goals of British elites who were already planning, even at the time of Napoleon, a global form of government. They were already looking forward to establishing some form of global governance, of which the Concert of Europe, established in 1815 under British leadership, was a foreshadowing. And simply because of the astonishing rise of British power during the 19th century, it became obvious, or it became a matter of faith almost amongst British elites, and not just British. There were a lot of people in America who saw this happening too, that it was presumed that British power would continue to grow and that British leadership would be paramount in the move toward a more organized global governance system. And so you can look at books that were written.
And that feeds through. That feeds through to people like Cecil Rhodes and his ultimately maligned influence, I think. But 3 points there. I just want to bring up very quickly. First of all, there are eerie parallels now to the situation between Britain and Russia, because for some reason, once again, the UK national security state has decided that Russia is our enemy and are ramming that narrative down our throats. Going back 100 years, I'm led to believe that the First World War was started largely by the British in order to prevent the rise of industrial Germany. Again, to preserve the hegemony that we'd achieved in the 19th century with our empire. But on the point of removing Tsar Nicholas II, he, of course, and King George V were first cousins. They shared grandparents in Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. And the Tsar petitioned his cousin George to be allowed to come to England after the revolution with his family in exile, and George turned him down, which didn't end well for the Tsar and his family, of course, who were all murdered by the Bolsheviks. So, of course, monarchs are figureheads largely these days, but I can't see how George would have conspired for the overthrow of his own cousin, would he, Richard?
Well, it seems like a terrible thing to us, but I think that people who are hereditary monarchs and who are brought up with that sort of culture and that tradition, I think liquidating one's own blood relatives, I think that's a necessary career skill that one must develop and has been for centuries. So you and I may not do such a thing to our relatives, but I think they would.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because my aunt was a terribly conservative, traditional English woman, and I confronted her with the evidence that I believed the assassination of Princess Diana had been at the behest of elements of the British royal family, shall we say. And I expected her to be shocked, but she dismissed the suggestion with, well, kings and queens have always had people killed, she said, you know.
True.
And that is indeed the case. Your book, let's have a look at your new book, Richard, which I believe you've got there, How the British Invented Communism.
I actually don't have a copy. <I'm sorry. laughs> I wish I could show it, but I've come empty-handed. It's supposed to arrive today. It just came out yesterday, and I don't have a proof copy to show. Sorry.
No. Oh, there we are. We've got the picture up on the screen of the cover, so all is well. Name for me then quickly. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Two or three other key figures in the British invention of communism. Who were the intellectuals or the deep state actors behind it?
Well, the key figure is Lord Alfred Milner, who was, the founder. If you're familiar with the Rhodes Circle, the Rhodes Secret Society, as Carol Quigley has revealed, Lord Alfred Milner was an early associate of Rhodes. Both of them came from Oxford and part of this close circle of British elites from Oxford and Cambridge who formed the Imperial Federation movement. And that is Milner actually went to Russia in 1917 and delivered an ultimatum to the Tsar telling him he was going to be overthrown, that there was going to be a revolution unless he did what the British wanted, which was they wanted him to sign become a constitutional monarch and basically turn over power to the Russian Duma, which was under British control.
And it seems that elements of the UK national security state have picked up that cudgel and are now threatening Vladimir Putin with it. I want to learn a lot more about this, Richard, but unfortunately we're up to time just for today. Very much look forward to seeing your book myself, How the British Invented Communism and Blamed It on the Jews, out now. Richard Poe, thank you very much indeed for joining us today on the Pelley Neil Taylor Show here on today's News Talk.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break for the headlines now, and when we come back, another hour of fascinating conversation, as always, here on TNT. We'll be right back.